and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the milestone of 1 million refugees entering Europe this year, fleeing war, poverty and persecution in Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan and Africa, and go to Geneva, Switzerland to talk with Joel Millman, the press officer for the International Organization of Refugees. We will discuss the glaring contrast between the welcoming acceptance of refugees in Germany and in Canada compared to the hostile rejection of Syrian refugees by the United States Congress and a majority of the country's governors, along with racist Islamophobic rhetoric from the leading Republican presidential candidate, Donald Trump. Then we'll speak with Jim Manley, a 21-year veteran of the U.S. Senate who served as a senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and before that as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy. He joins us to discuss why the Democratic Party establishment is missing a golden opportunity to expose their message and candidates to the American people at a time when almost all of the media's attention is going to the hateful and divisive remarks by the leading Republican candidates that largely go unchallenged. Then finally, we'll examine the culture of greed and excess on Wall Street with William Cohan, a former investment banker and best-selling author of Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. We will discuss his article at the New York Times, How Martin Shkreli, the Teen Wolf of Wall Street, Thrived, and the extent to which the business press enables con men and Ponzi schemers with flattering stories instead of hitting them with investigative journalism that would have long ago stopped Shkreli in his tracks. And joining us now from Geneva, Switzerland, is Joel Millman, who's a press officer for the International Organization for Migration, who previously worked as a Wall Street Journal reporter covering immigration and human trafficking. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joel Millman.
Thanks for having me back, Ian.
And the 1 million mark was passed today in Europe in terms of 1 million refugees coming in from largely from Syria. And I take it that the prognosis as we head towards 2016 is that there'll be many more as the war in Syria in effect escalates since the intervention by Russia. So is that your expectation, Joel?
Well, we hate to speculate. I mean, a year ago, I was fairly new in the job here, and we never could have imagined that the 219,000 that crossed in 2014 would quadruple in this coming year, and it did. So I just hate to speculate about what could happen because nobody anticipated this kind of escalation of the migrant movement a year ago. But we do think that the world certainly sat back and noticed this year, and we're beginning to see efforts across all kinds of spheres to bring some of this conflict to an end. So, you know, we try to be optimistic. We like Europe's flexibility, and we like the way migrants have been accepted in general. I just got finished working with the resettlement of all those Syrians going to Canada, so that was pretty gratifying. So we'll see. We'll see what goes ahead.
Well, of course, with just days left in 2015, the Geneva-based intergovernmental organization, the International Organization of Migration, which is your organization, Joel, have said that 1,005,504 people have entered Europe as of Monday, which is more than four times as many as last year's, and almost all came by sea. And of those, 3,692 drowned trying to make the crossing. And of course, that's a riveting picture. And I know the Pope himself weighed in and talked about the Mediterranean Sea being a graveyard. So it has definitely, I think, affected everybody's consciousness, particularly the picture of the Turkish policeman holding cradling the limp, dead body of a young child.
Right.
Where does Europe stand there in the world in terms of compassion fatigue?
Well, you know, Europe gets a bad knock, and I've spent a lot of sessions this past year hearing about is Europe doing all it can, and we've made it pretty clear that we don't think Europe deserves to be singled out for any special negligence or failure. You know, back in March, we among many other groups were concerned with the growth, the rapid increase of death on the Mediterranean, particularly on the route from Libya. And I remember personally predicting that at this current level of drownings, we could see 30,000 people killed this year. We're going to end up around 4,000 or 3,800, I think. It seems a little cruel, I think, just to toss around these numbers. But the reason it didn't come to 30 or 20 or even 15,000 this year was Europe responded pretty quickly to the threat. We were concerned that there was inadequate patrolling and lack of shipping power out on the high seas to rescue these people, and Europe responded rather quickly. In fact, it really turned on a dime, and this is after months of debate, particularly in the UK, where people were saying the let-them-drown strategy will be the only thing that will stop this flow. So we think that, on balance, Europe really behaved admirably this year, especially Angela Merkel in Germany, but not just her. I mean, thousands of common citizens came out and welcomed migrants and are still doing so to this very hour. So we think that that's going to set a benchmark for where Europe can go, and I'm actually pretty optimistic for 2016.
And again, I'm speaking with Joel Millman, who is in Geneva, Switzerland. He's a press officer for the International Organization for Migration, who previously worked as a Wall Street Journal reporter covering immigration and human trafficking. And the International Organization for Migration issued a report today pointing out that more than 1 million refugees and irregular migrants have entered Europe in this record-breaking year. And you mentioned, Joel, the satisfaction you got from being able to resettle Syrian refugees in Canada. Prime Minister Trudeau has just pledged to bring in 25,000 refugees within a matter of months. That, of course, is in stark contrast here to the United States, where the Republican Congress, have pretty much closed the door on Syrian refugees. The presidential candidate, Donald Trump, has called for a complete ban on all Muslims entering the United States, and the majority of the U.S. governors in this country have also said they don't want refugees settling in their states. So a pretty embarrassing contrast, I would say, between the generous Canadians and, I don't try to think of the right adjective to describe America, because it's not really necessarily a reflection of where the American people are, but it's certainly a reflection of where the Republican Congress is.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, you know, the problem is all immigration law and all immigration governance is that the pain usually falls on the weakest link. I mean, you see all the money being spent to securitize the American border. And who gets hurt is the teenager who, you know, dies of dehydration in the Arizona desert. And that person has no constituency, has nobody to support him, there's nobody who cares about him. His own family doesn't even know where he is when he dies. And this is the kind of results you get when politicians pander and they find the one individual or family that can't fight back. We call that bullying in any other context, but in migration it's called border security. And that's why I would say that Europe made a sharp turn this year. Europe said there were plenty of people who advocated let them drown, but they didn't prevail. What did prevail was a stepped-up effort, spending more money, putting more rescuers on the seas, looking for solutions all over the world. There was a very important summit last month between the African Union and the European Union in Malta to discuss. What we really realize now is a long-term marriage between, you know, job-rich Europe and job-poor Africa, and this is kind of thing that's got to be managed. We cannot rely on so-called market forces just to dictate the flows of this labor. There is going to be a change, and it's going to be rational eventually. It just wish it didn't take so much time.
Well, of course, again, contrasting Canada with the United States, Time magazine this year named Angela Merkel as a person of the year, I think largely because of how she's handled the refugee crisis, in contrast to the U.S. again, although, as I mentioned, I said perhaps a majority of Americans, it's in fact not a majority of Americans. A majority of Americans oppose accepting Syrian refugees, according to a Gallup poll, saying 60% are against granting refugees access here to the United States. So in this holiday of Christmas, we're not necessarily being a very Christian nation.
Well, that's probably true, you know, but like I say, it's easy to stir up fears. Unfortunately, the imagery of the conflict in that part of the world plays to things that Americans are fighting for. And politicians know this when they talk this way. They rarely prevail, though. I mean, Alan Simpson once told me that everybody saw what Pete Wilson did in California and tried to copy it. He was elected governor on a very the draconian view of Latino migrants, but it cost his party the support of that population probably forever, and no one succeeded since. And I think we'll see the same thing with this. So it's troubling, but it's not devastating. That's how I feel.
So in terms of Germany, then, how much is there this economic engine, if you will, driving emigration, even though this is coming out of a crisis? I've read, perhaps it's anecdotal, but I've read that many of these refugees that are coming out of Syria are highly educated professional people who just simply are escaping a Holocaust, really.
And, yeah, that's true.
And that they are exactly what Germany is looking for, a skilled labor force, because their birth rate is flat.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I talked to Syrians for a while, and I was on the border with former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia and Serbia, and also the border with Greece. And we saw during the summer, I mean, literally a parade. In fact, in Serbia, they asked everybody to go single file as they crossed the border. So it was quite a spectacle of this long line of men, women, and children massing towards the transit center where they'd be registered. You know, you met a lot of doctors, a lot of dentists, a lot of engineers, a lot of people who worked in computers. Very young, very dynamic, just exactly what these economies need in Europe. But, you know, there has been some writing, particularly in the European papers like the Financial Times, that discuss the stimulus program that goes along with resettling these migrants as almost a kind of Keynesian solution to slow-growth Germany. The government's going to disperse billions of dollars in euros, in individual grants to these families, and that's going to go directly to shopkeepers and rent landlords and shops that for, you know, new household goods. And this is a direct transfer into the economy that they're predicting will add a point of growth to Germany's economy in the coming year. I mean, few people actually see it that way, but even the cost of resettlement can be a benefit to the economy. And of course, you have to look seriously at what Germany and the rest of the Western European governments promised their citizens in their old age, and the cost of that, and where is this going to come from? Where is this revenue to pay for all these services going to come from, unless there are new workers, you know, contributing to the economy and paying their taxes? The math doesn't work any other way. I'm not sure Angela Merkel has articulated that particularly, but it's something economists are beginning to talk about in Europe. So this is pretty much a principle of economics, and we'll see it. We'll see this become part of the debate, I hope, in the years to come.
Well, it's interesting, the Keynesian subtext that you just told us about, Joel Milman. But in terms of what's out there in the public debate, a lot of the public debate about emigration in Europe, particularly following the terrorist attacks in Paris, have been about the idea that the Islamic State is slipping through their fighters with this huge flood of refugees. None of that's actually, well, I think one of the parachuters had come in back in from Syria, had he not?
They're not even sure of that. They found a passport that indicated such a thing, but we're not even sure where that passport was acquired. Many people argue it could have been acquired in Paris. There was a raid in the last 24 hours, I understand, in Belgium. Europe's looking very seriously at the trafficking in arms and how this attack was probably more linked to the readily available firepower in the shops in Belgium as it was to any ISIS fighters or Islamic State militants. I mean, this is, a continent of 500 million people are going to have a few angry misfits who have access to guns, as we know from our own country. This does not discredit resettling migrants by any means, although, of course, there are people that will exploit that.
Well, so just to sort of clarify this issue of the idea that the Islamic State is infiltrating their fighters into these refugee flows, as far as you're concerned, as far as the evidence you've seen is, it's completely exaggerated.
Well, it's very much exaggerated. We don't know of any real cases linking migrants who came in to terrorist acts. We know of names that have cross-filed and look similar. We know there's maybe a dozen of those. We can't say categorically nothing, but I mean, out of a million migrants, to say there are six or seven people that have a name that might link them to extremist activity before they came to Europe, I mean, that's almost statistically unavoidable, I would think. It's not cause for tremendous alarm, much less these conspiracy beliefs.
So when you say you witnessed this long line of refugees coming out of Serbia having to register, that process itself is sufficient, it would seem. I mean, the U.S. position on not taking refugees prior to the Republicans shutting the door was essentially that Homeland Security is in charge, and it takes, a year and a half for Homeland Security?
2 years, usually, yeah. It's very onerous and always has been. I mean, we had people in Thailand 20 years after the Vietnam War ended, 30 years still waiting for resettlement. So we know how thorough the U.S. is. Nobody is screened more rigorously than a refugee. And I've even seen cases of family reunification that take years because people have to manage to get a blood sample to a U.S. embassy somewhere to be checked on DNA and things like that. I mean, it's extremely thorough. The ones I saw in Amman, Jordan, and Beirut that were being processed by IOM for resettlement in Canada, a tremendous number of large families. You're talking about kids under 10 outnumbering adults, often 2-to-1 in some of these cubicles doing their screening. I mean, it's possible, I suppose, that there's a sleeper cell of bad guys, but it's hard to imagine when we see these families with little kids just waiting patiently to have all their medical tests done and all their paperwork finished. And I know that the settlement in Canada has really concentrated on whole families, so we don't see a lot of what look like single men or military age men, coming in this flow.
So just in the last couple of minutes then, Joel Millman, with the escalation of the Syria war in Syria since Russia intervened and now, of course, it looks as if Israel killed an important Hezbollah figure the other day, because that makes the pro-Assad Syrians wonder what kind of protection they're getting from the Russians. But in general, even though the UN Security Council is looking into some kind of a peace deal, Lavrov himself, the foreign minister, didn't indicate much optimism that the deal will happen. What's your expectation in the coming year in terms of what is generating this situation, which is this incredibly inhumane situation in Syria where over 200,000 to 300,000 people have died and the country's been basically leveled and flattened, and a third of the population is displaced?
Well, it's not a good next few months, that's for sure. But I think, conditions in the neighboring countries that were generally very benign for migrants, Lebanon, Jordan, Turkey especially, may have reached a saturation point. It's much tougher to make ends meet. It's much tougher to find work. This sort of grumbling in all the countries that Syrians are undermining the wage structure of locals. It's all part of a resettlement issue. But what we understand more than anything is the triggering of all these folks out of Syria this year, linked to several things. The siege of Kobani, of course, was a big one a year ago in Kurdistan. But the cutting of food assistance by the World Food Program and other aid groups really had a severe effect. I mean, people were getting by on $26 a month worth of food for a family, and that was cut to 13, and we started seeing large numbers of displaced persons in Syria coming out of Syria and now becoming international refugees. And that really, I think, got people thinking about how they can work much harder in the years to come, to bring peace and to try to resettle people close to their homes. So that's really the only thing that's going to reverse this tide.
Well, thank you very much for joining us from Geneva, Switzerland, Joel Millman.
Okay, thanks, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Joel Millman, who's a press officer for the International Organization for Migration, who previously worked as a Wall Street Journal reporter covering immigration and human trafficking. We'll take a brief station break. We're back questioning why the Democratic Party establishment is missing a golden opportunity to expose their message and candidates to the American people. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jim Manley, who's a senior director at Quinn Gillespie and Associates Public Affairs in Washington, D.C., a 21-year veteran of the U.S. Senate. He served as senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for the past 6 years, and before that, served 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jim Manley.
Thanks, Ian, as always.
Well, and thanks for joining us, Jim. What did you make of the flap over this last Democratic debate, where it's become obvious to a lot of people, including, for example, David Axelrod, who made the remark that that the DNC sort of put their finger on the scale for Hillary? It does seem very counterintuitive, the idea that at a time when the Republican debates are getting record ratings, they're dominating the discussion, dominating the media, that the Democrats should literally hide or bury their debates, and in doing so, bury Bernie Sanders to help Hillary, and there's no evidence that this in any way does help Hillary.
Yeah, that's a lot of good questions packed into one there, Ian. Let me begin by saying the good news is more people watched that debate on Saturday than I ever thought possible. I think it was like 7.9 million. But having said that, your bottom line is, I believe, correct. Though I must tell you, I don't have a good answer. For the life of me, I don't know why they keep on doing this. The fact of the matter is that, you know, not only obviously are the Republicans getting record number of people to watch their debates, but also, you know, the fact of the matter is, I mean, I'm going to say this as a Hillary Clinton supporter, she needs to use every chance she can to try and sell herself to the American people. And I've been watching, you know, very closely to find, you know, I know what David said, but the thumb on the finger, thumb on the scale, excuse me. I'm not so sure I'm going to go that far tonight, but I've been watching for months now to see, to make sure that they don't go out of their way, you know, to try and unduly influence help Hillary Clinton. But I think we can both agree that Saturday night's debate was an epic failure, and it shouldn't have been scheduled like that.
So, given that Hillary Clinton does well, and you made the point that she should be exposed further, and that Bernie Sanders is drawing record crowds, and most of the pundits suggest that he doesn't really have much of a chance against Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. This is his opportunity to get a message out there that's resonating, and it would seem to me that the worst thing that could happen to the Democrats is that the growing constituency that Bernie Sanders is bringing to the table, mostly young, those that are traditionally fairly apathetic and don't get to particularly engaged, the last thing you want is to discourage the very people who, for the first time, are being excited by politics.
Yeah, you know, and that is a very good point, one I must admit I haven't thought that much about. But when you phrase it like that, I mean, that only magnifies a mistake that was made on, you know, months ago to try and schedule this debate on a Saturday like that, just, you know, a week before the election. You know, to be clear, however, it's kind of interesting, just to play counterintuitive for a second. You know, the fact of the matter is Senator Sanders has never been a Democrat. He only quickly switched his party a couple months ago, though obviously he's been a loyal member of the Democratic caucus for months. I'm not so sure how much fundraising he's done for the DNC over the years. But the fact of the matter is that, I could not agree with you more. There, as far as I'm concerned, there have been attempts, whether deliberate or not, to try and underplay this debate so far. And again, I don't think that serves Senator Clinton well, and I don't think it serves Senator Sanders as well, who, as you just suggested, is doing a very good job of reaching out to folks that don't have a habit of voting these days.
And again, I'm speaking with Jim Manley, who's a senior director at Quinn Gillespie and Associates Public Affairs in Washington, D.C. He's a 21-year veteran of the U.S. Senate and served as the senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for the past 6 years, and before that served 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy. Now, in terms of the one of the issues that Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton disagreed on was this idea that the United States is the world's, if this is factual, is the world's only developed country with no guaranteed paid family leave policy, and that Bernie Sanders has he's basically supporting Senator Gillibrand's family and medical insurance leave, which it would increase payroll taxes for workers and companies by 0.2%, or roughly $1.38 a week for the median wage earner. And that's what Bernie supports. And Hillary says, no, she's got another plan, which she didn't enunciate. But then Bernie accused her of not being in sync with the tradition of the Democratic Party. She's disagreeing, quoting him, she's disagreeing with FDR and Social Security, LBJ on Medicare, and with the vast majority of progressive Democrats in the House and Senate today fighting to end the disgrace of the United States being the only major country on earth that doesn't provide paid family and medical leave. So this is not exactly fire and brimstone that they're throwing at each other, but what do you make of that difference? And do you think that Hillary Clinton is going to come up with a plan? She says that she's got some way that she's going to tax the rich, because she's made this vow not to raise middle class taxes.
Yep. A couple of things. First of all, I cannot wait. Let's take a step back. First of all, obviously, I thought it was right on Saturday to focus so much on terrorism, national security related issues in light of what's going on around the world. Having said that, I cannot wait for additional debates where they can spend more time working about discussing or debating bread and butter issues important to the middle class in this country. What do I think is going on? He's obviously trying to get to the left as much as he can over Hillary Clinton. This is an issue you and I have talked about before, Ian. His goal in life is to, again, drive her to the push her to the left to the extent he can, but I continue to believe that it's going to be awfully tough in the end to pull that off. You're going to go so far to the left, you're going to alienate independents among others that are anxious trying to figure out a way to vote for the Democratic nominee. So I applaud what he's suggesting, but based on the makeup of the Congress, not only this year, but what I expect to be in the next couple of years, it's not anything he's going to be able to pull off. So I'd look forward to hearing to what she's going to have to say. But this is what he's been doing for years in the Senate, articulating a very robust position on the left, and then trying to get his colleagues to move, use that as a wedge to get him to move closer to his position. So.
Well, but Senator Gillibrand is not known as a leftist issue.
Yeah, no doubt. Yep, very good point. That she is, and she's a rising force within the Senate. But the fact of the matter is that despite the fact that most, if not every other country, provides paid leave. Like that, it's going to take a while to pull it off. We made strides, but more needs to be done. So
what you're telling us then, Jim Manley, is that that there are kind of two possibilities here in terms of activating constituencies. Bernie activating a new constituency on the left that is appalled by what happened in 2008. The young are being excited by him, and he is drawing bigger crowds than any other candidate in the race. But then you just mentioned the fact that some independents may be a little scared off by policies that they see that coming as from being too far on the left. My understanding is that, and I've talked to a bunch of Republicans about this, that they basically sort of mumbling, grumbling, quietly saying, if Trump gets the nomination, I'm going to hold my nose and vote for Hillary. Do you think that's a possible constituency that the Democrats could win over?
You had me going until that last part. I don't know how much inroads a Democrat, especially Hillary Clinton, is going to be able to make into the Republican ranks. But I am concerned, and or I would suggest to you and your listeners, that there is a significant difference between the large crowds that he is generating in Minneapolis, where I am right now, or Wisconsin or New Hampshire, versus the large numbers needed to elect the next Democratic president of the United States. And so it's great to watch the energy and the enthusiasm. She needs to continue to try and figure out how to tap into that, which, again, brings us back to our basic premise. It was a mistake to do this on a Saturday when, you know, young folks would have liked to watch. They were going to Christmas parties or watching football or whatever. So, but having said that, I'm not quite sure how much inroads they're going to make to the Republican Party. But like I said, if Donald Trump, were to get the nomination, you can Katie bar the door and all, you know, prognostications are out the door, and who knows what's going to happen.
Well, it would be an extraordinary change, I think. And can one of I tend to cover foreign policy, Jim, and I cannot believe that the United States would elect, and it may happen, a leader who's really in the model of the Vladimir Putins and Erdogans in Turkey. A strong man. No moral compass, no values, just power, negotiation, deal-making, et cetera. And little wonder that Putin and Trump are buddies. It's
yeah,
a really...
But there's something going on around the globe as well. You got Marie Le Pen in France. You've got the change in government in Poland. You've got a strong anti-democratic streak going on in Hungary. So, while Trump brings to our process a unique kind of crazy, we're at a point in time where, for a lot of different reasons, including economic uncertainty and whatnot, a skilled manipulator, can play on the passions of folks and, get them to, say all sorts of hurtful things. So it's just something to watch out for. But, like I said, I, for one, months ago, downplayed every chance I could the idea that Donald Trump, was going to make a significant run for presidency. But, he just keeps on ticking, and despite the lickings he's taken or he's giving. So, weird phenomenon.
It is a weird phenomenon. Well, then let me throw something else by you then, given that we talked about Hillary and Bernie and the constituency that Bernie's bringing in and how to keep them in the tent. What about having Bernie as the vice president with Hillary as the president?
I don't know if I see that happening. I've watched him closely for years, spent a lot of time interacting with him on the Senate floor, but the fact of the matter is, despite the fact that he caucused with the Democrats, he never was a Democrat, and he's always been proud of his independence. So I just don't see a guy like that taking a position like that. He's stuck in his ways. He believes passionately in what he argues for. That's the good news. The bad news is, like I said, he's stuck in his way, and I don't see him taking a position like that.
But my understanding is that the biggest constituency in the United States is the independents. There are more independents than there are registered Democrats and registered Republicans.
Yep.
That's a fact, right?
Yes, that's correct. And I don't think that the best way to approach independents is by speculating on Bernie Sanders to be the vice president of the United States. Again, despite the fact that I agree with him on many positions, the fact of the matter is, his views, at least, are very polarizing within a significant, I believe, swath of the American public. It's he's got good basic ideas, and he drives it to the left every chance he can. I mean, bipartisanship he did a fantastic job in cutting a deal on a veterans bill, but most of his time has been spent in the Senate articulating, views and programs, you know, far to the left of the, I think, a great majority of the American people, and for as far as it's concerned, the Senate Democratic Caucus as well.
Well, I was just basing it on the sort of logic that if he's not really an authentic Democrat, there are more independents than Democrats, then you'd be adding people if he joined.
Yeah,
but
no,
it doesn't.
I understand that.
It doesn't work that way, you say. Right?
Yeah, no, I don't think so. And to be clear, you know, this Democrat thing is, you know, it's kind of a technical thing. Obviously, his views are in line with the Democratic Party, but you know, technically, only recently did he become a Democrat. So. So anyways, it's just something for you and your listeners to think about. I only started thinking about it a couple days ago. And the fact of the matter is, I'm not aware that he's ever given any money to the DNC, and I don't think he's done much to campaign for his colleagues over the years as well. So, but he was always a reliable vote for Senator Reid, and God love him for that.
Well, then, just in the last few minutes then, Jim Henley, there are more debates, I understand, at least I assume, since, you know, when the election year hasn't even begun. Well, you wouldn't believe it, but we're a little more than a week away from 2016, and I'm assuming that they're going to have some more debates. And do you think any of the annoyance expressed by a lot of people have weighed in on what they consider to be the counterintuitive, brain-dead idea of burying the Democratic debates. Are they going to pour some sunlight on them and try and bring some ratings in the new year?
No, I don't. I having said that, I don't think that's going to happen. I believe that they set their plan and they're going to stick to it. There have been attempts in recent months, though not recently, to try and expand the horizon and set up new ones, and DNC has always dug in against it. And sorry to say, but in light of this recent kerfluffle, I don't see that happening. I don't see things changing. You know, of course, we got another just as an added complication. Obviously, there was a back and forth over, you know, the stealing of the election files, so that obviously didn't win any many friends in the DNC as well. So, but no, I don't see that changing. And you know, it's too bad. I've publicly said before, I'll say it again: whoever reached this deal deserves to be fired. But the fact of the matter is, it is what it is at this point in time. And Sanders, for one, is just going to have to make the best of the situation. He's not shy about, you know, calling out hypocrisy, and he's not shy about getting his views out there, so he'll manage to do it. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, just to square the circle and get back to the original premise, I think it hurts Hillary Clinton as well. I think she needs to continue to try and demonstrate, again, if only to these independent voters, that, you know, she's the right person to be the next president of the United States, which, again, I believe she is.
Well, Jim Manley, we will see what happens here, and there is at least a year. But there's no question that the debates are where most of the people get their political information from. So they're very key events. And I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And have a happy Christmas and holiday.
Thank you, Ian. You too.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Jim Manley. He's a senior director at Quinn Gillespie & Associates Public Affairs in Washington, D.C., a 21-year veteran of the U.S. Senate. He served as senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for the past 6 years, and before that served 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into why the Wall Street Business Press enables con men and Ponzi schemers with flattering stories instead of investigative journalism.
the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck or a pound, a mark, a yen, a buck or a pound is all that makes the world go around, that clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money, 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 money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is William Cohan, is a former senior Wall Street investment banker for 17 years at Lazard, Frere & Company, Merrill Lynch, and J.P. Morgan Chase, as well as a New York Times bestselling author whose books include Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street. He's a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and writes a weekly opinion column for Bloomberg View, and he's latest book is The Price of Silence. He also has an article at the New York Times, How Martin Shkreli, the Teen Wolf of Wall Street, Thrived. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Cohan.
Thank you for having me.
So, Bill, in your article in the New York Times, it's pretty clear that Martin Shkreli thrived on Wall Street because the reporters were basically, at least the business press, were enabling this con man and Ponzi scheme with flattering stories instead of hitting him with investigative journalism, that which would have long ago stopped him in his tracks. So does that explain the wretched excess and greed that he represents?
Yes. I mean, of course, that is a fact, Ian. And that doesn't mean that it's easy to unwind wrongdoing, deception. If a hedge fund manager, a banker, a financial schemer wants to deliberately deceive people, it's very, very hard to catch them. You have to have, frankly, been probably being given a tip. You know, what I found, and that doesn't happen very often, what I found sort of interesting about this story at the very moments that Martin Shkreli was deceiving his investors, according to the allegations in the indictment and the SEC complaint. Again, he's obviously innocent until proven guilty. Does not look good for him if what they allege is true. But let's take for the moment, assuming that it is true, you know, at the very moments that he was deceiving his investors, that he was engaged in this mini Ponzi scheme, that he was robbing Peter to pay Paul to make it look all good and kosher, that was the exact moment that he was sort of being lionized in the press and Forbes and in other places about this sort of great young whiz kid, 30-year-old hedge fund manager whiz kid. And, of course, he was sort of adding to that and by being quoted, saying, you know, basically obfuscating what he was really doing and what was really going on with his hedge fund. And, you know, when publications are sort of in the business of creating lists of important hedge fund managers or, you know, 30 young hedge fund managers under 30, you know, inevitably you find people like this who are charlatans and deceivers. And it's very, very hard to know what's really going on because, of course, so much of what they do is confidential. You know, their investors are confidential. They very often don't have to file any information with the SEC. It's very hard to know exactly what they're up to until kind of it's too late or until, you know, the feds, who have subpoena power, are able to get a hold of this information and make it available to the rest of us. So on the one hand, the journalism and business journalism and the business cable networks are enablers of hedge funds managers. They use the media left and right to advance their own interests, what we call talking their book, and they do it all the time. And there's so much air and so much print space and so much blog space that, of course, it enables that. And that's just a fact of life. On the other hand, though, of course, it's very difficult to you know, figure out what's really going on at these firms, and if there's deception going on, it's very hard to get that unless somebody tips you off to it.
Well, given that in December of 2012, Forbes named Shreklee on its list of 30 under 30 in finance, and that the Business Insider praised him for exposing the critical need for balance between the interests of shareholders and patients. And I take it that must have been more recently when he had used money from these failed hedge funds to buy the Turing Pharmaceuticals, where he jacked up the price of a life-saving critical drug by 5,500%. That's when he started to get publicity. So that the Business Insider praise goes beyond the normal sort of flattery to suggesting that somehow he had some kind of principle involved. What is balancing the interest of shareholders and patients when it comes to jacking the price up of a life-saving drug by 5,500%?
Yes, I think we both know the answer to that. There is no balancing. And, of course, he said his mission was to, you know, help people with life-threatening diseases and come up with new drugs to help them, when, in fact, what he was really doing was jacking up the prices of these drugs that help them with their life-threatening diseases. If we could just allow me to play pop psychologist for a second, I mean, it seems to me that by September of this year, which is when the New York Times and other publications began writing about Martin in a serious way related to his jacking up the price of these life-threatening drugs once he got a hold of them, By September, he obviously knew that the feds were on to him. The FBI had been investigating him. The Eastern District of New York, U.S. attorneys in the Eastern District of New York had been investigating him. The SEC had been investigating him. I don't know. Call me a pop psychologist, Ian, but I think that this was sort of like a cry for help. He wanted to get caught. He knew that this would raise his profile substantially. I think it got him on the front page of the New York Times. I mean, that's definitely something you would not do unless you wanted to essentially guarantee that you get caught, because he knew by then what he had done with his hedge fund. He knew that the feds were on to him, and I don't know whether he was trying to, like, obfuscate or try to change the story or something. But it seems, you know, again, I'm not a psychiatrist or anything, but it seems to me that the guy knew, as Jean-Paul Sartre would say, les jeux sont faits, and that he was just sort of waiting to get caught. And, of course, he did.
Well, I suppose, in a way, another answer to your question, how Martin Shreklee, the teen wolf of Wall Street, thrived, is not just a critique of the business press, but also, surely, of the SEC. I mean, is this how normally? I know they've successively cut their investigative budgets, their staff, etc. They've been starved by various budgets, particularly lately by the Republican Congress. But is this a sort of normal lag between somebody that was clearly a Ponzi schemer? I know it's always easier to say it in retrospect, but do you think that the authorities were slow on the uptake here with Shreklee? I mean, it's the impression you get is that he's making himself the pinup boy for greed on Wall Street and outraging the American public is sort of, you know, basically backfired on him, and had he kept quiet, he might have gone on a lot longer. So what's your opinion of the enforcement authorities?
Well, you're absolutely right that their budgets have been cut, and also at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, their budgets have been cut at a time when, frankly, they need more firepower rather than less firepower. But I think, and we've probably talked about this before, I mean, I think the whole attitude of the Holder Justice Department has been to, and obviously he's not there anymore, but had been to sort of tread lightly on white-collar crime, and especially, crime related to the financial crisis. So that was sort of a philosophy that I think came down from Eric Holder from on high with his so-called Holder doctrine, where he basically said the consequences of indicting or prosecuting wrongdoing at these banks could be devastating. It might put them out of business. He was, you know, concerned about doing that. I mean, that's not something you would expect, you know, the Attorney General of the United States to say, to soft pedal going after these guys. But I also don't want to suggest that it's somehow easy to capture this wrongdoing in advance of it happening. You know, the case that they laid out against Martin Shkreli is pretty damn convincing. And I'm sure they have a lot of evidence because they cited a lot of evidence in their indictment and in the SEC complaint. Whether or not it's sort of easy to track that in real time, especially, you know, the thing is, you know, we're used to Bernie Madoff here, right, who was a world-class Ponzi schemer and bilked people out of billions of dollars. I mean, Martin Shkreli, if he had, you know, to your point, if he had just laid low, if he hadn't, you know, bought these orphan drugs and then raised the price on them, you know, 5,000% and made the front page of the New York Times, we wouldn't be sitting here talking about him, and nobody would ever have known this guy was, because he basically, you know, bilked, and you know, these are sort of rough numbers, like, you know, 20, 25 investors out of a total of like $10 million or something. I mean, it's not a lot of money in the scheme of these things when you're talking about Bernie Madoff, who bilked thousands of people out of billions of dollars, and he's, of course, become legendary. You know, Martin Shkreli, I mean, he's interesting because, he's sort of young and outrageous, and he spends a lot of time on Twitter, and he spends sort of all day on some sort of streaming video show that he does, and he bought these orphan drugs, and he made himself sort of infamous by jacking up their prices. But, you know, in many respects, this would have been something that would have come and gone with maybe some sort of citing by the SEC, and, you know, he would have been on his way. Instead of now, he's sort of facing, you know, years in prison because he raised his profile so darn high.
So just to say then that there has been a change under Loretta Lynch, that there's a little more prosecutorial activity, shall we say, on Wall Street?
Well, I don't want to make too much of that. Clearly, here's an example with Shkreli where they're definitely throwing the book at him. And he thinks, of course, it's because, as he said the other day, it's because, you know, he raised the prices on these drugs. When Loretta Lynch came in, she basically, you know, renounced the Holder Doctrine. She said, okay, we're not going to do that anymore. We're now going to seriously try to prosecute crime in these big banks, and we're not going to worry about their reputation, and we're not going to worry about what the follow-on consequences are. So I give her credit for abandoning the Holder Doctrine. It's maybe too little too late to try to prosecute people who were involved with the financial crisis, which to me is a huge missed opportunity and sends the exact wrong message to people still working on Wall Street. But I feel like Loretta Lynch is already off to a better start than Eric Holder. And the Shkreli case is a good example of hopefully what she in the Justice Department, along with the SEC, are going to do now. Now, of course, she also used a lot of firepower going after the FIFA executives, and, you know, why she felt the need to prosecute, you know, Swiss executives of a sport that, you know, has a lot of importance worldwide, but not so much in the U.S., I'm not exactly sure. I guess she saw it and decided to do it. She follows it up now with Shkreli, and if she does it with other things, I mean, I'm cautiously optimistic that maybe she's going to turn around all the wrong things that Holder was doing, what, of course, will never be, what it's probably just too late for, given the statute of limitations, is actually prosecuting the people who did the wrong things leading up to the financial crisis, which I think is, you know, will go down as one of the biggest mistakes in recent financial history.
Well, on that subject, just in the last few minutes, William Cohen, of course, the movie based on the book by Michael Lewis, The Big Short, does to some extent expose some of the sort of greed and excess and sociopathic behavior on Wall Street. Do you think it may well revive people's outrage? It's, as you say, the statute of limitations is such that most of them have got, are going to get away with it. But what did you think of the film?
Well, I saw it a few weeks ago, and I certainly thought it was entertaining. I might be too close to the subject matter because there were parts where they felt that they sort of had to explain things that to the audience by, you know, using these sort of cutesy techniques of sort of breaking into the fourth dimension or whatever they call it, where the actors look at the camera and talk to the audience, or they get in you know, these famous woman actress sitting in a bath, bubble bath, explaining collateralized debt obligations. I mean, you know, to me that treats the subject matter a little less than seriously, but maybe that is how they have to appeal to a broader audience. I enjoyed it. I don't think it's going to lead to any additional outrage, and that's probably a good thing, because that would be highly frustrating, given that really the statute of limitations has just about run out on trying to prosecute anything related to the financial crisis, because it's basically been 10 years, and that's the statute of limitations under one fairly obscure a law called FERIA that they've been relying on lately.
Well, just in closing then, does this mean that Wall Street will continue to dominate our politics, throwing money at Washington, and that the financialization of our economy will continue to grow?
Absolutely, it does, Ian. And nothing has changed between the symbiotic relationship that exists between Washington and Wall Street. Nothing has changed in the way Wall Street bankers and traders and executives get compensated, what their incentive is to continue to take risks with other people's money. And until you change those two dynamics, were two very fundamental dynamics that caused the financial crisis in the first place, neither of which has been addressed by any Dodd-Frank legislation or Volcker rule or any outrage over continuing scandals in the financial sector. None of that has been addressed. None of that has been addressed by any prosecution. So, yes, it's going to unfortunately stay the same, and I suspect we'll have some sort of financial hiccup of decent-sized proportions pretty soon here.
Well, William Cohen, I thank you very much for joining us, and I wish you happy holidays.
Same to you, Ian. Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with William Cohen. He's a former senior Wall Street investment banker for 17 years at Lazard, Frere & Company, Merrill Lynch, and J.P. Morgan Chase, as well as a New York Times bestselling author whose books include Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street. And he's a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and writes a weekly opinion column for Bloomberg View. And his latest book is The Price of Silence. He also has an article at the New York Times, How Martin Shkreli, the Teen Wolf of Wall Street, Thrived. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.